This is The Conversation. It's episode 216 with Hilde Lynn Helfenstein, or Hilda. It's her first name in the Scandinavian version. She is a Los Angeles-based gallerist who also runs an alternative space in Houston, does pop-up shows in New York and beyond. Definitely go check out theconversationpod.com to see images of some of her shows as you dive into this with us. Oh, and by the way, I'm Michael Shaw. It was great to be talking live in the room again with another guest. Hilde and I discuss everything from gallerists challenging the focus on blue-chip male artists, resilience in the art world, to the importance of non-conventional education and dropping out of grad school as she did. I found Hilde's intelligence and passion to be formidable, and I know you will as well. On the back end, I'll catch you up on my favorite Weiss links for the week, for the last 2 weeks, particularly including a brilliant piece of wisdom from legendary artist Adrian Piper, who has turned out to be about 45 years or so ahead of her time, as you will hear. All right, let's dive into that conversation right now. Stay tuned for the back end, and thank you very much for being here. I'll talk to you then.
When he said that, I swore I saw, like, the reptilian, like, third eye blink when he said that. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm getting rid of Facebook.
Wow.
This is so scary. And I did get rid of it for a long time, for 2 years, not that long, for 2 years I got rid of it, but it started it was impossible because then I moved to Europe. I lost touch with so many friends, and Facebook is a good utility when you're like, hey guys, I need to rent a truck for an hour. Can I pay somebody $50 or my SLR is broken? Can I borrow it? You know, like, it's such a good tool, especially for artists or people in the art community, to just talk to each other or like, hey guys, I'm moving back to San Francisco. I need an affordable apartment. You know, it can be a really positive thing. And so then I just was like, oh, I guess I need to go back. And then I felt kind of like pathetic because I thought I was so cool and like, you know, such a rebel for deleting it. And then I went back and was like, hey guys, I'm here.
How easy? So you deleted it? How easy was it to get back on? As yourself?
Well, you know, because they do collect so much data on you.
Wasn't hard.
No. It was like picking up where I left off, you know?
Yeah, right. So getting back to Ukraine, I'm just kind of picturing, you know, all these people that are like, oh, Hilde's in town. I realize as you're describing more your social media base that I'm wondering if many of them were already following you and it was just like they already knew who you were. And so it's like, oh, we could meet up in person.
Not in the instance with Ukraine, because that is sort of an obscure, more of an obscure thing. When I go to like Sweden, whenever I go to Scandinavia, I work with enough Scandinavian artists that they sort of know, and I get really bombarded when I come into town there because everybody knows that I'm there, and then they want to talk, and they want to show me what they're doing.
In Oslo, or what towns are we talking about?
Oslo, Stockholm, Malmö, Copenhagen, just the bigger
cities. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I sort of get people that way. But then I've had other things, like last year, the most touching thing that has ever amounted from social media was I was at Freeze on like the first day just walking around by myself. I feel usually pretty anonymous when I go to those fairs because I'm not highfalutin like some of the people that are there. And this girl came up to me and she said, are you Hilde? And I said, yes, I am. And she got tears in her eyes and she gave me a hug and she was like, it's so important that a young woman is doing what you're doing and you have such a strong voice and I just love you. And I was like, this is kind of creepy, but it's also a huge compliment, you know, because I'd never met her before.
Right.
So in that way, it's like, those are sort of the benefit type things
right.
that come from it sometimes.
So let's see if we can figure out what she is referring to in terms of this, how strong you are in these. Well, obviously these things you're doing include putting on shows that include a lot of artists, right? So artists are grateful for the opportunity, you know, and you've worked with, if you had to guess, how many artists would you say you've worked with at this point in your young
I would say life? I've probably worked with 50 to 70 artists.
In solo and group shows?
Yeah, group. So obviously I don't represent anybody. That's sort of the difference. I think that is a form of responsibility that I would take extremely, extremely seriously. Like,
in a way that some galleries don't?
Yeah. I mean, that's your livelihood. And a lot of the artists I work with happen to have children and stuff like that. And just the idea of being responsible for, like, how their parents pay their bills. It's not that I don't care. It's just that, you know, at this point, until I have, you know, a larger clientele base, if somebody needs to go with somebody else so that they can pay their bills and buy a car, do whatever they need to do, fine. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I get it.
Right.
But your question, I work with a lot of artists. I think I work with a lot of artists that could fall under current, like, buzzwords, but I don't do that intentionally. I'm not like, they have to be woman, they have to be a person of color, they have to be queer. I like to say this, you know, like, sometimes you look at, I've heard arguments for why there's so many men in the art world and who have these sort of long arcing careers and really make it and become, you know, the ones that end up in the history books, and then women end up getting like a little side chapter. And people are like, oh, well, it has nothing to do with the fact that they were men. It's just that at that moment they were speaking to the zeitgeist of the moment, and that's sort of the intellectual lineage of what people were thinking about and doing back then. And if that's true, then I say, well, if I'm going to be true to my intellectual lineage and sort of the zeitgeist that I fit into, I just happen to be more interested in women artists. It's not that I'm like, oh, if you have a penis, you're not welcome to this party. It's just that on a blind taste test, I tend to like female art better than male art.
Okay.
Not always, but
right. Well, that's fine.
The majority, you know.
Getting back to by the way, I was thinking about various directions we could go when you started talking about, you know, the whole trendy and you know, what types of artists, and I don't think I want to touch that. I will say, just maybe I will touch it a little bit, because I will say that when you described how it was with men, and, you know, pretext to talking about how what your taste is, I thought it doesn't seem like it's that way now with, you know, the way you were describing men and these arcs of their careers, and that it was just the context of the time. I was thinking it doesn't seem like it's that way right now. Does it seem like that way to you?
Well, it does when you look at blue chip galleries, and you look at, I mean, come on, we can list like six blue chip female artists off the top of our heads, but we can list like 30 male off the top of our heads, you know? I'm not going to name.
That's fair. Okay.
Yeah. I'm not going to name any names. I just want to say this. I did just hear an interview with a blue chip male artist where he said, I don't even think about money. Money isn't even a concern in my practice. And I was like,
oh, you said the P word, but you were quoting somebody.
Well, it just was like, I was just like, you know what? I don't want to.
What show was it?
It was that, new documentary that came out called like Blurred Lines or something.
Oh God. You suffered through that. How was it?
I watched it twice on an airplane because I had nothing better to do.
Right.
I watched it one enraged, and I watched the second one being like, whatever, this is an old way of thinking and I'm not a part. You know, I was able to be more detached the second time I watched it.
Right. Yeah, as a guest, I haven't seen it and I'm not going to watch it, but not necessarily for exactly the same reasons that you hated it, but maybe for some of them. But in any case, I mentioned it to a guest when we were and I said, have you happened to see this art world film that came up? And he said, yeah, I think I saw the trailer. He said, it looks awful. And then he went on to say, you know, when it comes to certain people who write about kind of that blue chip world, you know, that you were sort of referring to, he said, it's not that that's the art world, it's an art world.
Completely. Yes, completely. It is an art world. It's not the only art world. However,
mm-hmm.
I've been thinking a lot about this with history in general, right? Like, I spent this summer studying everything that happened at Versailles because I think it's super interesting. And if you think about all of the little characters, right, that are in just one chapter of any history book, how many people had to die, how many people were completely buried and overshadowed and are never mentioned and in any part of history, just so that they can get like 3 inches in a history book that somebody might hear about in 2018. That happens in art history, especially over and over and over again. And I'm really dedicated to trying to change that because, again, it's exactly what you just said. That might be the world that you live in, but not you, but those people over
right.
there might live in.
Right.
But that's not what I'm observing here. So
yeah.
I'm trying to give people as proper and as beautiful and as high of a platform as possible to make an alternative version of the story viable in the future.
So that to me raises or as you were saying that one something that I was thinking about is that, and this partially goes back to the movie Blurred Lines as you watched, and it also goes to specifically I'm just going to mention it because it's on my mind and I don't think it's healthy to necessarily repress it, and that is that there's this Damien Hirst show, which I haven't seen, nor do I plan to see, but the way that the collectors, you know, sort of swarm behind that crap, you know, and pay these ridiculous amounts of money, just reminded me that it's often, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, the collectors who are driving certainly the blue chip market, but in other ways, you know, a lot of the conversation. And so I guess I say that to ask, to what extent do you feel like with the work that you're doing, the curating, the shows that you're putting on, that cultivating, you know, a collector base, for lack of a better term, is something that is really instrumental in affecting that conversation? Big sigh, just for those of you not in the room.
Okay, well, there's a long answer to that,
sure.
But I will try to keep
no,
it.
No, you can take as much time as you need.
Okay, so the one thing I love about contemporary art, especially in 2018, is the godlike ability that an artist has to declare just about anything as not only art, but their art. We have given such incredible creative license through our intellectual lineage that, you know, I could walk out with this microphone that I'm speaking into and, you know, call it, you know, stolen microphone from Art the Conversation. And it's my piece, you know, and if I have a market and somebody really likes my work, they will buy it. And that's that.
Right.
I actually like that. I believe that with the exception of work that sexually exploits children or, you know, physically violates the safety of a non-consenting adult or work that hurts animals, I kind of believe that every art, everything deserves to exist under the sun. Because like science, like anything else, like everything pushes us forward. Everything. So it all has a right to be here.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, the market, in my opinion, is oftentimes more telling than what it is that artists are actually making. The day that the Women's March happened this year, which I thought was yet another very historic, strong moment for women. It's right in the middle of Me Too, right in the middle of Time's Up. All of these things happen. I walk into a gallery that night to go to an opening, and I see the most, in my personal opinion, sort of Lisa Yuskovaj derivative, sexually exploitative paintings of like naked young girls with their legs spread in their gym locker rooms. And there's a bunch of white dudes on their iPhones and on their iPads making deals outside. And I heard that this show sold out immediately.
I think I know the show that you're talking about.
Yeah. And then I go next door because there's this like incredible ceramic show going on at the same time.
Now I definitely know what show you're talking about.
And they'd only sold three of them. And am I mad at that artist that he painted those paintings that I personally don't give a crap about? No, I'm glad they exist. I like the ceramics better, but that's me. That doesn't mean anything. What am I upset about? I'm upset that obviously there's a market that immediately stands there and upholds something in the same time that we have a president who brags about sexually assaulting women. And then these paintings sell immediately out the door like hotcakes. Because like everyone says, you know, this is free market capitalism. The market is supposed to dictate what it is that people actually want, right? According to those rules. And then that just makes me really sad and understand that my job is way bigger than just me. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think partially, but I think I'm going to have to get you to elaborate on that last comment, which is this job is bigger than me. So does that mean that there's only, is one of the subtexts of that, that there's only so much that you can do, or?
Well, I mean, so, you know, I don't want to castrate art. Like, I think art can and should be sexy. I think that the conversations need to be big and juicy. They need to be vital, right? Like, picture.
We can have. Let me just share something with you that occurred to me. So I've been doing. I put out a few bonus episodes, like a handful, that are things that are for people who've donated to the show, and I feel like we could actually do one of those about that particular artist that you're talking about. So mm-hmm. So now that you know that, maybe you will less obliged to, yeah.
Yeah, but all I'm saying is that, like I said, I think that all work has a right to exist within the constraints of don't hurt
right.
people.
Mm-hmm.
What conversations do I want to push? Like if you look at sort of the arc and the zeitgeist of the things that I'm thinking about and that I'm talking about in my gallery and the artists that I choose to work with, I would say in many ways, they create a microcosm that is solution-based to what's going on in the world right now. Me opening the gallery in LA, when I opened it, for me, it was sort of the only way that I could give myself and my peers a reprieve from the news. And like, I mean, I think the day that I signed my lease for the gallery, Aleppo was under siege. Like, I mean, everyone was freaking out. Donald Trump was just getting closer and closer. I mean, everybody has just been on fire, sort of spiritually, intellectually, on every single level. And I've just felt like there has to be sort of a place where people can still go and think and make and talk and still be afforded an intellectual life that exists outside of only talking about Donald Trump. You know, that's not all your practice is about, I'm sure. That's not what I want to live my life, you know, going around only talking about. And it just felt like at that point there was nowhere to go. And I also am obsessed with beauty and all these other, you know, reasons that would draw me into art. But I really just felt like more now than ever, I felt like we needed each other. I felt like there needed to be a place where we could hold each other, you know, and not physically, but, you know.
Yeah, yeah, metaphorically.
Metaphorically speaking.
So in other words, that's kind of your mission. Is that one version of your mission statement for your gallery, would you say?
100%.
100%. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, not the only one, but...
Right. But just to... I mean, I don't want it to be like too big a deal or too like make it feel like I'm hammering down on this specifically, but I'm not sure if I heard from you regarding my sort of specific question about collectors. So mm-hmm. In other words, maybe you can just address that specifically. So in other words, as the way I preface that question, you know, that there's a certain amount of control in the conversation, the market, the non-market. I think what I guess for lack of a better description, what I got from you is the market might be having its own conversation, but we're having our own conversation, and that's valid. And I get that, and that's great. But at the same time, I wonder if in addition to having that conversation, if it would be beneficial to you if you were to say, you know, have a steadily rising number of collectors that you cultivate every year or whatever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Our collectors have been interesting. I'm yet to encounter, I have not been anointed by like the LA Boys Club of collectors. I know that they know I'm out there. The people who collect the work that I show tend to be, they tend to be people who are more passionate about art objects and sort of the individual story of each artist rather than how somebody's going to do at market or what booth they have at X, Y, and Z fair. I also operate outside of that. I don't do art fairs. I don't want to do art fairs.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they are money dumps. And I think that most people are lying when they say they make money at art fairs because I've worked them and I know that it's not true. Some people do make money, but most people don't. So what I do to cultivate collectors, which I think has been different than some of my counterparts, is I go to different cities and I open up alternative spaces and then I spend periods of time there. So I really get to know them because I don't know. I don't think I'm cool, you know? I'm not one of those cool, trendy, it girl type people. I'm one of those people that you have to talk to me and get to know me, and you have to look at the artists that I'm working with and understand where I'm getting them from. I'm not just going to New York and picking artists out of big Chelsea galleries and showing them. I travel extensively to really find these artists and build really intense relationships with them. And then I become something of a guardian for them. And the people who are drawn to the way that I work, they also tend to be people that are a little bit more on the spectrum of treasure hunters versus trophy collectors.
Right. You know? That's a good analogy, yeah. Yeah. Just to push back a little bit, though, on your... I mean, I appreciate that you're not, like, one of those types of New York, you know, it girls or whatever that you were sort of alluding to, but I would wonder, though, with the following that it sounds like you have on social media, you know, if in at least in a certain framework or perspective that you are not kind of, you know, you're the it, like, pop-up gallery girl or, you know, whatever, something like that.
Maybe. I think people like the underdog story. I mean, right?
I like the underdog story.
Everybody likes the underdog story. It's the American story.
Except for the collectors.
Yeah. No, but people, if you watch the arc of... This is so cheesy. It sounds like a TV show. I swear, it's so ridiculous. But if you watch the arc of our Instagram, you can literally see the day that I signed the lease and I'm laying on the floor. Derek, my business partner, I always joke. Have you heard about this thing called Instagram husbands?
I don't think so.
It's really funny because first of all, we're not a couple, but Instagram husbands are those poor guys that you'll see like in the arts district with like their girlfriend posing in front of like the angel wing murals. And they're like, babe, get me from this angle. Wait, do it again. Hold on. Let me flip my hair. You know? And I always joke that Derek's my Instagram husband, except he does it when I'm not looking. And he actually can take sort of good pictures. And so we've just been building a story. And we do the same with our artists too. You know, we want people to know that these objects don't just come from a vacuum. They come from real people. They come from a dialogue. They come from, you know, it's always interesting when you go to these like big megaplex studios in Bushwick or whatever, and you go to 9 or 10 studios, and whether these people know each other or not, you start understanding that there is a palpable spirit or zeitgeist or whatever that's sort of running through the building, and you start understanding that all of these people are affecting each other. And so it's really fun when you have these disparate art objects, but the more you start tying in who these people actually are, why they're actually making what they're making, and what it comes out looking like, all of a sudden there's a very interesting story that I could never have planned or written that just exists with these people. And I think that's the story that people like about what I'm doing, like on social media, is that I'm trying to actually tell a story instead of just only showing like perfect install shots after the gallery opens.
Right.
I like people to know, like, this is how I found this, you know?
Yeah, so you're after the there as opposed to just this cosmetic, completely superficial bullshit kind of thing.
Of course. I mean, yeah. Why would it be interesting?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously, the type of people who post on Instagram, that kind of stuff is not going to be interesting to a lot of us. So, but it is just to other people.
Just like I'm probably the most boring Twitter person in the world.
Yeah. So you mentioned Derek, who is your business partner, and that was good timing because it was this just after the second time that you said we, you know, as in we, Hilda, the gallery. So talk about if the we is just essentially the two of you and what that relationship is like and what he does.
So Derek and I have known each other since we were 14. His grandparents live 4 minutes walking from my parents. And we went to homecoming together in 9th grade.
Is this in North Dakota?
No, this is in Parkland, Florida. So,
Yeah, we're not even going to try to catch up with all the different places.
Yeah. And
Parkland, the Parkland.
Yeah, Florida. I went to Douglas. I went to Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, where that shooting just took place.
Wow.
Which is crazy. But in 9th grade, I'll never forget it, when Derek laid eyes on me. No, we were both really shy. Very, 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 very. I mean, I was terrified of boys until I was like 18 at least, you know. But we went to homecoming together, which the extent of that was he put a corsage
on me. Right.
And we like posed for the picture, and then I was like, okay, bye.
right.
But we've known each other for years.
Yeah.
And we lost touch with each other. And okay, here's a weird social media story that I swear if there's anybody on Twitter that would like to explain this to me, please get at me at Hildy Gallery and explain how this can happen. In 2011, I hadn't seen him since I was like 19 years old. And in 2011, I was, I don't know what, 26, 27. It had been a long time since I'd seen him. And this is before everyone was so interconnected. Like, I didn't have his email address. I didn't have anything. I went to bed one night. I had this dream about him that he was a grown-up. And in the dream, we were talking and we were best friends in the dream. And I woke up and I was like, that's such a nice dream. I wonder what Derek is up to these days. And I go to work that day and I have an email from Twitter saying, at Derek Simons wants to get in touch with you. And he was like, and then I wrote him back on it and he said, oh, that's so weird. Your Twitter tapped me, or like, you know, did like, tried to initiate something. I didn't use Twitter. I don't use Twitter.
Right.
And I was like, that's very, I mean, obviously I believe in like some metaphysical weird things, but that was very strange because I hadn't talked to him or seen him in years. And
you're not a known sleepwalker as far as you know.
As far as I know, no. And so then we started being friends and he's a painter and I was in the midst of getting my BFA at San Francisco Art Institute and he's sort of a self-taught painter and he'd spent a long time actually living a monastic life. So he had sort of left society for a while and had been in Thailand and then was in Hawaii for a long time, just like foregoing all material objects and eating brown rice, drinking water and meditating. The opposite of me. I was like drinking wine and being crazy in Europe, you know? But anyway, we stayed in touch and then he just always believed in me and I don't know how to explain it. We have a really nice friendship because sometimes you think good things about yourself, but you don't have anybody on the outside who's telling you you're doing a good job. Cause like my parents don't understand art. Everyone in the art world's so competitive. No one will ever tell you you're doing a good job, you know, but he was just always like, you're amazing. Like you're going to do something amazing one day. So then this is years later now. At another point I was in San Francisco and I came down because I curated organized an exhibition here. And he was in Europe and he said, don't leave LA. When you get back, we have to talk about something. And I was like, okay. And so I stayed in LA and he came back like a week later and he said, it's time for you to open your own gallery. You've worked for enough people now. And I was like, okay, but that's a lot of work and blah, 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 blah. And he's like, we're going to do it together. And so I said, okay. So we have a very interesting relationship because he's not from the art world at all. We call him the sweeping monk at the gallery, but we cannot function without the sweeping monk. Like, he is the one that keeps the gallery pristine. He does all of the art handling. He's meticulous and like very detail oriented. And we always joke like his favorite job is to magic erase on the walls, but really that is just as important as anything else we do, because if we don't have a nice space to exhibit work, then what's the point in doing what we do? So he sort of takes on the sort of logistical roles in that way with storage and art handling and install, deinstall, and then I work with the public. And I find artists, and I curate exhibitions, and I write. And that's sort of our split. Right. But it's just as much him as it is me. It's just that we thought Hildy looked better in All Helvetica than Derek. And we just decided to call the gallery Hildy.
That's fair. Yeah, yeah. I think it has a better ring to it. That's fascinating that he made this not only that he made this transition from monk to co-gallery owner, but also that he just somehow had the gumption to say, we need to start, or you need to start a gallery, I'm going to help you. Mm-hmm. I mean, did you wonder where that came from? Did it come? How did he make that leap?
I mean, it depends on how deep and honest you want to go with it. But the bottom line is that basically since we got back in touch when I was about 26 in 2011 until about 4 years later, which is completely the trajectory of when because I trained as an artist, I never ever in 10,000 years ever thought I would be doing what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
But when I jumped on this train, and I used to joke and call myself the world's oldest intern because I started interning when I was 26 years old. My self-esteem was really low at the time. I felt unemployable. I was living at home with my parents. I felt like shit. And he was just the one that was always like, no, you're great. You're going to be great. And he was coming from a really strong spiritual practice. And he used to pray for me. And, you know, he used to, like, every time I'd be like, okay, Derek, I'm going out on this new quest now to try to figure out this next step of my life. He would literally, like, do prayers around me and, like, pray with me. And, like, not to a Christian God or not to anything, but, mm-hmm. you know, he sort of, I think, had a spiritual investment in me as a person. And
you picked up on that when you had that dream, apparently.
Yeah. I mean, I know it sounds illogical, but if you have any belief in anything in the unseen, I mean, that world does exist too. And miracles do happen. Like, crazy people do believe in you and will help you start your dreams, you know?
You just called Derek, your partner, crazy?
No, I'm calling myself crazy.
Oh, he you're the crazy one, and he was saying he believes in you even though you're crazy?
Or, I don't know, maybe we're all crazy. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to call Derek crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy in the good way.
Right, right.
You know
right.
what I mean?
Yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah, you mentioned just a little while ago about his being complimentary, you know, and urging you on and being supportive in that way, in contrast to how competitive everybody is in the art world. And I was glad to hear you say that, because I have mostly felt that way, and that it is hard to, it can be very hard to feel like there's a supportive community, you know? I mean, that's very fleeting from my experience. I'd kind of be interested to know how that, if in fact that is still your belief, how that's manifesting, you know, as you're running this space and other spaces too.
Well,
because when you're, and I'm just going to say one, sorry, I'm just going to say one more thing, and that is, it's very different when you're running the gallery than you're one of the artists showing in the gallery.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm learning about having healthy boundaries as I'm in the second year of doing this. My first project space was in my apartment in Harlem, and that was different because that place was so, like, decrepit that I never felt like it was home. But this summer I allowed two artists to come live with me, not just in my house, but share my bedroom, because my house is so small, for 2 months while we commissioned this enormous solo project for them. They're a duo. They work together. And
so the two of them were sleeping with you in your bedroom?
Yeah. Well, they had the king size air mattress, and I had my, and that was, and they brought their cat. So that was sort of the most hardcore thing that I've ever done to really express my devotion and support for other artists. We kept joking that, like, in the future, like, we'll have a retrospective and do the same show, except it'll be, like, in my mind, it'll be, like, them in this, like, long 70s golden Cadillac, And like, it'll be like four armored black SUVs, two on the front, two on the back, just like cruising down Pacific Coast Highway. And we'll just like redo the show, but like in a Damien Hirst, like over the top crazy way. I was like, but for now, like, we're all going to cram into my tiny Yaris and we're going to share my bedroom and we're going to share my little fridge and right. we're just going to make it work, you know?
Right.
So, you know, I don't like people in general who complain about things and then they don't do things. And it's amazing. I've learned it's amazing, especially this last year, because I do everything on a dime. Like, if you say you want to do something, like, just the act of speaking is enough to initiate something way bigger and way crazier than you ever thought was possible. And so for me, it wasn't enough to like sit around and be critical of the exhibitions that I see in LA, because I do see a lot of shows where I feel like they're lackluster. I also know that I don't know everything about where the work came from and blah, blah, blah. But there's too many times I walk into galleries and I'm so underwhelmed, and I can feel the like lovelessness just oozing off of these objects that are in this blank space. And I don't ever want to put a show on like that. And maybe one day I will, because I'm just too big to fail or something. But as of right now, that is not the kind of shows that I put on.
Right.
You know, I kind of feel like if I'm going to fail at this, I'm going to do it like with a lot of, I'm going to be on fire when it happens, you know? So I really do my best to support artists in whichever way I can. I mean, we've commissioned a couple exhibitions now head to toe. I mean, completely. And, you know, and I've gone on these crazy reconnaissance trips to other countries to like pick up work at weird train stations to bring, you know, like I really sort of try to go the extra length to make our exhibitions as interesting as they possibly can be.
And so I think in regards to my question, you're describing a scenario in which you're feeding, you know, these people literally and figuratively almost with tremendous support. But is that, can you maybe get more specific about how you see competitiveness and that kind of thing playing out?
Well, I think it's really funny because I've had a few art dealers who love me, who really have taken time to almost be like an elderly to me, which is very rare, because these are very busy people who technically could be making $1 million handshakes on a golf course somewhere or doing whatever it is that they do. And they'll take time out of their day and drive in really lousy LA traffic to like swing by and say what's up to me, or, you know. And so I've definitely had that. On the other hand, I've had other, it's usually with dealers, it's never really with artists, but I've had other dealers who, the only thing I can think of is they have to be intimidated by me, because I'm like, why would you be mean to me? I have like the smallest, like one-legged chihuahua in this dog fight. Like, there's no reason for you to take swipes at me like that. Like, no reason. And they
can you elaborate? Are we talking about just specific, you know?
Here's a perfect example. I had a group show. One of the artists that was in the group show, a fourth party, not their gallery, not me, a fourth party made a video talking about their press. They were getting interviewed about their press.
Are you sure they were getting interviewed about their press?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. They were getting interviewed about the thing that they do.
Okay.
In their studio. With.
It's I'm called so their art.
Sorry.
It's called their art.
I'm
it's
so
it's
sorry.
Okay. It's okay.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
Okay. bad habit. Okay.
Yeah.
So they were being interviewed about their art.
Right.
And because that person was in my show at the time, I shared that video, which doesn't even mention my gallery. It actually mentions their gallery.
Right, right, right.
Doesn't even mention mine.
Right.
On my social media. Within 45 minutes, I get an email asking me who I thought I was trying to make it seem like I represent them, and that they would no longer like to ever do business with a person who would do something like that ever again. Wow. And I'm just like, wait, I just gave your artist a free advertisement, essentially.
Yeah.
If we were talking about branding, like in the fashion world, I just gave them a free fucking advertisement.
Yeah.
So, and as far as I know, people like me better than they like that person anyway. So I was putting a positive spin on that artist. And I felt sort of offended in that moment because I felt like, Go pick on, you know, Larry Gagosian or something. Go pick on those people. Don't pick on an artist who just started an art gallery who you, again, I can only deduce that they're somehow intimidated by me because nothing else makes sense. There's nothing. I would think that this person, if they're as important as they say they are, it's like Donald Trump with Twitter, like fighting with Alec Baldwin. Like, aren't you the president? Like, go run the country. I'm like, aren't you a big art dealer? Like, why are you worried about a video that I didn't say, hey, guys, I represent so-and-so. Check out this video. I just said, congratulations. Look at this awesome video that just came out. That's all I did, you know? And so it's things like that sometimes where you're just, you know, I don't know. I don't like that.
Let me ask you this. Did anybody give you any advice in regards to that other than just ignoring it?
I don't know. No, not really. I mean, I think people assume that I have really thick skin, and I do. I do have thick skin. You have to have thick skin to do this. But sometimes, no matter how strong or thick your skin is, you're just going to have these moments where you're like, I do everything for the artists. I do everything for the collectors. I do everything for everyone. And like, I do this one thing and you just pick on me, you know, and you feel bad for yourself for a minute. And then, you know, literally you just go like lick your wound, chill out, have a drink, go for a walk, go eat something, go hang out with somebody outside of the art world. Remember that it literally doesn't matter. And then you just go back.
Yeah.
You know?
It reminded me of gallerists, especially more modest-sized ones, you know, who are doing everything for their artists. And it's like, it's to the extent that you can't imagine why anybody would have the gall to complain, you know, like, mm-hmm. What do you want? And so that made me want to ask you if, despite the picture that I've gotten from you about your relationship with your artists, if you have had occasions where they've, you know, despite everything you're doing for them, that they've been difficult in any way yet.
Yeah. So every single artist is their own special snowflake.
To use a now newly recharged word, right?
No. I used to be this is what I was saying before about boundaries. I used to be way more involved with artists, where mm-hmm. I would hang out with them in my spare time. And I mean, I still go to some of the same parties that they go to, but it's also because a lot of those people are my age too. You know what I mean? It definitely, there's a weird overlap where I'm going to be in social situations with them, but you know, I don't have them over for just a dinner one-on-one anymore. I don't, date them. I don't.
Yeah, that would probably.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, those things happen all the time.
Do they?
Oh yeah. And I really tried to sort of make some distance and some boundaries. Like Derek knows, sometimes I'll
look at him and I'll be like, keep them away from me right now. Because I know that like maybe I've had a bad day. I have a bunch of other things going on. And if they come to me with something that in my mind is a minutia of a problem, I'm going to freak out. And I don't want to be that kind of art dealer or gallerist who's mean.
Right.
So, and Derek is very good at this because he's the monk in the relationship where he can kind of like keep everybody at a nice distance so that we can play nicey-nicey because that's important. And I would rather, I've worked for dealers who would scream at the artists and put them down and threaten them and do all kinds of things. And I don't want to be that person, but I'm beginning to learn and understand my own temperament. So there are times now with boundaries and certain things where I'm just like, I'm building an office right now. The major part of the gallery is closed because we're for construction right now because I used to have an open office. So people could just come in and out. And it's like, I know that you might think that I'm just sitting here looking cute in front of my laptop, like drinking a latte and like playing gallerist on my computer, but I'm actually working right now and I can't talk to you, you know? So we're building a private office because I have to have it. And also
that's hilarious. That is brilliant. That is so brilliant. When Jenny and I spoke, one of the things that we talked about, because we had just gone and seen like five shows and we were talking, and she had worked at a gallery for like 3 years in London. And we talked about gallery etiquette, particularly like I explained at one point that there are some galleries that are big where they have somebody at the front desk who is almost explicitly dedicated to like greeting the people. And then you have other smaller, modest sized galleries where, you know, if they're not super friendly to you when you come in, it's because they're working.
Yeah.
And I can see how, even though, and I was at your gallery that one time, so I know that what is now your former office was on the second floor, but very obviously visible when you go up there, that artists especially who are like coming by would want to go in. And when you have a door now, though, how's that going to work? They're not going to knock on the door and assume that they can come in and talk to you too?
No, so we're closing off the whole second floor. And the second floor is just going to be office space and private viewing, just because the downstairs is, I think, big enough and does the job well enough. And I just made the decision after doing this for a year and a half that okay, I'm just going to back up and say this. I think this is anybody. When you start a business, your own business, when a person starts their own business, you begin to see the type of person that you are under pressure and under stress in ways that I wasn't aware of before.
Ah.
And so I have realized that I need the space, you know? And so it was just a decision that I had to make for myself if I want this to be at all sustainable. I need space and I need distance.
Right.
So that I can get my work done. And then, you know, we have a camera, we have a doorbell. When people come in, I can come down. We have Derek downstairs. We have an intern downstairs. I will be notified. But I guess also, too, because of the social media presence and because I am the sort of face of it, people genuinely get excited to say hi. They're not doing anything wrong.
Right.
I want them to say hi. I want to say hi to them. But I also am like deep in like a 45-minute mind train writing an email. And I just know that for me to get back to where I was is going to take me 20 minutes to like get back into that. And so it's just not working. So
what kind of email are you writing that's involving that kind of commitment and dedication?
Well, it may or may not be an email, but it may be a press release,
right?
Or it might be texts about the shows. And I don't know if you've ever read anything. I write them all. I take a lot of pride in them. It's kind of one of the few areas where my art making is still visible in the gallery, besides the fact that I curate the shows.
Mm-hmm.
I really take a lot of pride in what I write for the gallery. And sometimes it's really hard because it's you know, I'm like a rain cloud and I'm floating around and collecting all of this water. And at a certain point, it's going to rain, you know? And I need to get to that. I need to get to the raining point faster sometimes than the water has allowed. So I need to really concentrate.
So when it's raining, that's when you're writing.
Yeah.
You've got to be writing. You can't be interrupted.
No.
Because then the sun's going to come out and it's all going to be over.
Yep. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No,
is that
makes
an okay
sense.
Metaphor?
Yeah. It's great. I love how he makes the metaphor, but it's good. Well, you mentioned, so here are some, unless you have anything in mind that you want to revisit, there are some things that we talked about last time that I feel like they're these greatest hits or maybe big topics that we could get into. There's like, you mentioned Gagosian, we could talk about how you worked at Gagosian. You talked about how much debt and credit cards, you know, and the way that you're running your business in terms of probably putting a lot of money up front and going, you know, and putting on a card. And you talked about your short-lived marriage to a filmmaker. So these are some of the greatest hits that we could. What do you feel like any of those listeners would be particularly interested in hearing about?
Watch, I can hit them all fast.
Okay.
Gagosian was like finishing school for me.
Right.
And I'm extremely grateful for the experience I had there. Would I do everything like he does? No. But I got to be a part of a world-class operation and see how it worked and see how things look up close and what the fine print says. And for that, I'm extremely lucky because I felt like a fraud. I felt like I wasn't even supposed to be the person that was there. Okay, point.
But wait a second. That's a very, very generalized version of that. And I'm not going to pry because I know you have an NDA for that job and so on. But when you say finishing school, are you learning, like, A, about what a contract looks like, B, what the interpersonal dynamics are between, you know, gallery helper and collector, gallery helper and artist? I mean, are those some of the things we're talking about, or what were you talking about?
I really observed how they...
Is that where you observed the artist getting yelled at by the gallerist?
Actually, no.
Okay.
They're very good to their artists, actually. They treat their artists wonderfully.
Right.
No, that was a frustrated mid-level dealer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The kind that I don't want to become.
Right, right.
I think it's very important if you work in retail, if you work in any sort of hospitality business, we're selling a premium luxury item. So when you're buying a piece of art, you're not just buying the art, you're buying into its aura and what it, and its social aura and what it means to possess that item. And the kind of sort of, for lack of a better word, lifestyle that you must be living or you're supposed to be living if you can afford, you know, to buy a $450,000 Richard Serra, you know.
And that's just a drawing probably, right?
No.
Or work on paper?
You get a small sculpture.
Small sculpture, okay.
No, but then you have to treat a person who's buying work in a certain way, and there's a certain kind of follow-up, and there's a certain kind of presentation that you have to give those people. I mean, I get dressed every day like I'm going to go and sell a Richard Serra. Every day, rain or shine, I'm wearing heels, I'm completely dressed, I have my makeup on, my hair is done. Every day, even though if I sell like one $3,000 work of art, I'm happy, you know, or if I do that in a week, I'm happy at this point because I'm so new at it. But I wake up every day and I put this, my drag on, as RuPaul calls it, you know, mm-hmm. because I understand that people are paying for a certain something. Like people go to Barney's, you know, and they spend $600 on white V-neck t-shirts. There's a reason they can get away with that. It's because they have the aura of Barney's. you know? And then you get a latte when you go to Barney's, and the person there knows you by name. And like, there's just a certain level of treatment that you get. And I really observed that at Gagosian. And it's those kinds of things that were like finishing school to me, where I was like, there is a certain way to treat people. Also how you treat the art, you know, making sure that your art handlers present the work in a correct, like just these, they're tiny little points of decorum.
Right.
But when you're asking a certain price point, it's demanded.
Right. Right.
And I think that that's fine.
Right. How much though, was it a change for you to put on your selling aura, for lack of a better term, you know, as to maybe how you might have been before?
Well, I think that I was kind of cut out for this anyway. Like, kind of always. It's funny that people always believed me to be an art dealer before. Because I started doing this as a performance. I don't know if I told you that.
Tell me.
So I sorry guys, so many stories. I was a friend of mine, Henry Gunderson, has this art gallery called Water McBeer, which, without saying too much, may or may not be a real gallery.
That sounds like a gallery that has an aura.
And Water McBeer hired me to be their executive director of sales. So I would go and do this performance at art fairs as the director of sales for this gallery. And people started buying into that, and a bigger rumor started in New York that I was selling art than that I was making art. And I just sort of thought that that was funny, that people were sort of more interested in this role or this character than like my more vulnerable, quiet, weird artist side, you know?
Right.
And we've all got to eat, you know? So I figured, I guess I can do this, you know? And that's sort of when I got into working at galleries.
Wow.
Because
they paid you to go to the fairs?
Yeah.
Decently?
For me at the time in New York, yes.
Right, right, right. Yeah, no, I think you answered the question, but I think I'm just wondering. I mean, I'm correcting myself in my head because I'm thinking most artists are not really the types that dress to impress, you know, when they walk out, because especially if they're artists who work in studios where they're working other than they're on their computer, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then I corrected myself in my head because I thought, well, you know, there are certainly some artists who maybe don't dress like that to the studio, but they definitely dress like that when they go to openings or they go out mm-hmm. otherwise. So I guess I was just wondering, did it feel like something you embraced, or did it feel like something that, you know, you just have to sort of, this just has to be the way it is, whether I like it or not?
No, I'm pretty sure I know there's a lot of ways that this can come off insensitive because of all the issues of gender that are happening in our culture right now. But forgive me, I hope this doesn't offend anybody, but I've always been extremely girly and whatever that sort of, my mom just used to always say, Hildy's all girl. Like, I never wanted dirty hands or sticky hands. I always wanted to be really dressed nice. Like, oh, okay. I sort of have always been like
right,
this.
Right, right, right.
So, but then it became more fun for me when I sort of actually, like, I love RuPaul. I listen to her podcast, their podcast every week. But I love, you know, there's all different kinds of drag. You know, this is art dealer casual drag. But, right. You know, there's your tennis drag. There's your, you know, Sunday brunch drag. Like, everything is just a different sort of character. So
yeah,
I didn't wear blazers before. I love playing with people's minds now. Like, when a blonde lady in a power blazer, it creates the most cognitive dissonance I have ever seen in my life. People do not know what to do but to listen to you, because you're wearing a really strong blazer, but you're also sort of like embodying like California sunshine, you know? People don't know what to do, and then they're like, okay, she's wearing a blazer, so she must have authority. Like, I went to the doctor's office yesterday, and I was wearing a blazer because I had a meeting afterwards. And they were like, somebody, I asked where the bathroom was, and they directed me to the doctor's lounge. And I'm like, oh, I'm not a doctor. I'm a patient. And it was just because I was wearing a blazer, you know?
Yeah.
So it's funny how clothes have these sort of weird effects on people. It doesn't mean anything.
That could be a whole conversation right there.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you for clarifying all that. Do you want to, were you interested in ticking off the other things in a minute or less?
Well, yeah. So the money thing, I would just say, because I don't use credit cards anymore, and I am very slowly but surely paying off my student loan debt, I'm a huge advocate for dropping out of grad school. And if you ever want to talk to me about it, you can find me at my gallery, and I'll tell you why I think you should drop out of grad school.
Make an appointment first.
Please make an appointment. Because I think you can essentially do everything that you need to do in grad school and not pay $100,000.
Sure.
I dropped out of grad school. I'm really glad I did. Being married, you know, I married somebody straight out of college after I finished SFAI, and he was part of Stadel Schule. And
sorry, what?
It's this school in Frankfurt.
Okay.
So it's this real, it's like the kind of Yale of Europe.
Okay.
And because he and I collaborated on everything together, and they're very funded there. It's like the opposite of here.
Right.
I got to travel around the world with him and his class and put on shows, and we made two films together. And it was sort of when that relationship ended and I came back to the States that I think I had $82 in my bank account, and I had to move back in with my parents. And that is when I began the journey as the world's oldest intern.
I think you're being a little hard on yourself on that. I thought this earlier, because I think there, especially now, and this is only, what, you know, 6 years ago or 7 years ago, somewhere in that neighborhood. If you go to grad school, and then even on top of that, if you do like the Sotheby's program or whatever, there have to be 26, 27, 28-year-old interns out there all over the place. That's not a big thing. So it's your past self. If you want to beat on your past self, as we all do, you know, you're more than welcome, but you don't have to. It's not that big a deal being a 26-year-old intern.
No, I'm just always really impressed with these young kids that I meet. I'm like, you're right. 24 and you're done with grad school. I was losing my mind. When I was 24, I think I was living on an artist residency in Spain and drinking like a gallon of like the local red wine a day and hadn't worn shoes or showered in a week and was like living this very radical other lifestyle. So I'm like, wow, you have it together. Like, you know how to make a resume. You got a job. You curate shows. Good for you. I was crazy.
Retrospect, see the value in that residency that you did and drinking all that and whatever else you were doing?
Actually, it's the reason there's lots of reasons that it ended up being good. But it's just been a different path for me. Like, the school that you asked me about in Norway, the first school I went to was this anarchist art school in Norway, but there was no, I wouldn't say there's no intellectual infrastructure, but there was definitely not like a rigid academic one. And so we just had access to as much material as we wanted. And everyone had a studio that was like big. And so we could do anything we wanted. And instead of like what I think academia tends to do, and I think these are both good in moderation, is academia tends to makes you compartmentalize everything, right? And place everything on a historic continuum and understand where things come from, blah,
with
blah,
way,
blah.
Way too much information.
Yeah. And then on the other hand, what I was experiencing in Norway was like, I mean, the headmaster, he was amazing. He'd like walk around, you know, stoned all the time, smoking pot with his dog, wearing like a wife beater and trousers up to his waist with suspenders and
very bad teeth, and he'd just walk around and be like, "What are you doing today, Hilda?" And I would like tell him, and he'd be like, "I don't know, it looks like shit to me. I'll see you tomorrow." Like, you know, and that was like the extent of my critique at that time. And it was really fun because we could just kind of do anything we wanted. And if it was bad, we could throw it away or turn it into something else. And it was really fun. Right. So then when I got to San Francisco Art Institute, which has a very, very rigid academic structure, and I mean a huge dropout rate, because most people think they're going to go have fun at art school, and then they get there and it's like a AAA accreditation. It's like the same as Harvard as in terms of their liberal arts program. It's really difficult. So like a lot of kids get there and they're like, I didn't know I was going to have to write 15 page papers on semiotics. Like, I'm out of here, you know?
Yeah.
And luckily I had gotten all that crazy shit out of my system by the time I got there, so that I was sort of ready to be the like nerd at the front who was like, "Yes, but it says on page 47 that, you know," and I was, right. I was a nerd on that end. And it was good that I sort of had both of those educations in order to have the kind of brain that I have now.
Yeah. Right. Good. I think you ticked through those pretty nicely.
Yeah.
So let's wrap up, and then we'll do that little that bonus thing and see what happens with that. So Hilde, thank you so much for talking to me.
Hey, I hope it was a pleasure for you.
It was a pleasure. Okay. Was it a pleasure for you?
Indeed it was.
Excellent. All right. And we're out. Thank you very much again to Hilde for talking to me. Yes, I'm going to go back to the original Scandinavian version. I almost was going to insert her saying it, but I thought that might be a little too much. Anyway, big thanks to Hilde again for talking to me. I hope you guys enjoyed that. And she was generous enough to stick around for about another half hour or so when we recorded that bonus segment. And yes, this is the time in the show where I tell you that this is a listener-supported show, and I would love to share that bonus segment with you where we do talk specifically about that show that she saw and I saw, and she had a lot of problems with, not just the work itself so much as the symptom of the work, and much more, including a very personal and bizarre anecdote that she encountered with a collector. I'll be very happy to share that bonus episode with you if you have already contributed financially to the show, or if you do now. You can get that and the past 4 bonus episodes with a donation of just $25 or more one time via PayPal, or become a Patreon supporter at $5 or more a month. Both of those are linked through theconversationpod.com/support. And if you want one, I still have about 10 bumper stickers with the P word. So the P word, practice, but the middle of it has expletive symbols. You may have heard, you may not, but Patrick Kamut, artist and art teacher in Pittsburgh, came up with this design with me, and we made some t-shirts, and he made some bumper stickers, gave them to me, and now I offer them to you if you are so inclined and so interested. So let me know if you want one of those. Otherwise, if you just want the bonus episode and past episodes, you can donate to the show, as I mentioned. You can also support the show non-financially by following on social media at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. You can become a fan on Facebook. You can really help the show out by leaving a great review on Apple Podcasts, formerly known as iTunes, or any platform that you use otherwise. Thank you very much in advance for that. And now let's get to the Vice link for the week. Mainly, I wanted to share with you the one that really stood out to me. And I think it comes at a good time because Adrian Piper, a legendary conceptual artist who you may not be familiar with because her work is not particularly market friendly. She has, I believe, still a retrospective at MoMA, Museum of Modern Art in New York right now. This is from the art writer and consultant Robin Sembalist on Twitter, and this was put on the Weiss link. Hyperlogical Adrian Piper challenges mansplaining, in parentheses, before it was called that, in 1975. So I guess 43 years, to be technical. And so it's two separate panels, if you will. They're both collages with the cartoon bubble, and I presume that's a very young Adrian Piper at the bottom with a, it's a black and white sort of Xerox copy style image with a cutout bubble of her talking, but she's not saying anything in the picture. She's looking very somber. And this is what the first one says. "Take care that you do not interrupt me before I am finished, for that will indicate to me that you were not paying careful attention to what I was saying." And then the second one goes, "Also be careful not to nod too rapidly, avert your eyes too often, yawn, blink, hum, or sigh deeply. I will not tolerate it. I will make you wish you hadn't." Awesome. So that's Adrian Piper from 1975. Can I really say add anything to that? I can, actually. Bear with me. I did see Adrian Piper give an artist talk many years ago, and so long ago that I don't really remember much about it other than it was pretty entertaining. And I do remember that my classmate, who I was so green and, you know, young at the time that I just probably didn't have the conceptual capacity to hold on to all of her wisdom, I regret to say. But my classmate, just a tiny bit older than me, seemed to be able to, at least to the extent that he said after it was over, "That is the best artist lecture I have ever seen." So there you go. All right, one more bit before we go. And this is a follow-up to something that I talked about last episode outro, and that is regarding the gallery here in Los Angeles, the soon-to-be former CB1 Gallery. Tim Schneider, former guest of the show, wrote a piece in ArtNet called Risk Versus Reward. He sort of dove in a little bit more into the thinking behind some of the artists involved. So essentially, I will just read some excerpts from his piece, not all of it, so you get the idea of what happened if you're not familiar with this story. On Tuesday, 13 artists once affiliated with Los Angeles CB1 Gallery published an open letter accusing co-founders Clyde Beswick and Jason Chang of consistently failing to pay money owed from sales, as well as selling consigned works without notifying the responsible artists. Beswick responded to all initial press inquiries with a written statement that he and Chang, quote, "are working hard to resolve any and all issues with the artists whose work we have shown," unquote. But that work became even harder on Friday when Beswick confirmed to the Los Angeles Times that CB1 will shut down, as I announced earlier on this show, when its current exhibitions end on May 19. He centered the blame on, quote, "slow sales" and, quote, "cash flow issues," stemming partly from the gallery's 2015 move to a larger, more ambitious space in the city's arts district. As every piece written about the CB1 scandal has noted, Beswick served more than 13 months in county jail and state prison after a 1997 conviction for embezzlement and tax fraud. This means that every artist who joined forces with Beswick and Chang knew they were dealing with a former white-collar criminal, and yet they still hopped into bed with the gallery faster than a dude concerned his Cialis is about to wear off. That's a trademark Tim Schneider metaphor, by the way. To be fair, people in plenty of other industries willfully overlook legal damnation for the sake of upside all the time. For example, outside investors handed over $3 billion to hedge fund kingpin and auction house aphrodisiac Stephen A. Cohen's 0.72 asset management last month, just weeks after the expiration of Cohen's SEC-imposed ban on accepting outside money due to insider trading at his last fund. But the gallery business elevates this tendency to overlook past indiscretions to another level. Crucially, Beswick and Chang appear to have had plenty of options in the talent pool, even while their artists were vocalizing their current non-payment problems. This excerpt from Brian Boucher's exchange with Emily Davis Adams is revealing. Adams says that a number of artists have even asked her for introduction to CB1 Gallery despite the allegations of misconduct. "They tell me I'd rather show my work even if I don't get paid," she says. Setting aside the legal implications, this phenomenon speaks to the enduring appeal of the brick-and-mortar gallery. While exceptions exist, the vast majority of artists still want to have actual physical shows in actual physical spaces where their work can be experienced in its full glory, not to mention supercharged by the old-fashioned fanfare of special events and social exchange. Artists also generally want the reputation upgrade of being represented by someone who operates or at least has access to one or more of these spaces. And they want both of these things so badly that they're willing to put themselves at serious risk of being played for fools. In Beswick's case, this lure wasn't just so powerful that artists were willing to excuse previous lawlessness for the opportunity to exhibit. It was also powerful enough to convince them to stay silent about suffering, to quote the open letter, financial abuse categorized as systematic for years. All right, Tim, you get the last word. Thank you guys very much for being here. Thank you for listening. Do let us know what you think of the show, generally, specifically, or otherwise. And I will talk to you in a couple of weeks. Ciao for now.